Thank you, Bill, for an eloquent and cogent statement. George?
I think I should probably preface what I'm going to say tonight by, first of all, saying that in all candor, I really did not want to do this. And I want to tell you how all of this started. I was quoted in Reed's paper, which is always a dangerous thing. And Phil read my quote, and so he wrote me a letter. And he wrote me this letter and said, I think it would be good if the two of us did a public debate so people could understand our differences and we could perhaps help understanding over the idea of abortion. And I looked at this because I tend to get a lot of letters like this, and I thought, oh, forget it. And I put it down. I almost think Phil is really a Presbyterian at heart because he persisted. And he came after me for a while. We talked, and so finally we got together and had lunch. And this is the really good thing about this, is that in the course of conversation over lunch, Chinese food, telephone conversations, and so forth, what I learned is something I always have known, and that is that while you may disagree on parts of life, you do not disagree on all of life. And therefore, it is important to be able to talk to people. And out of the course of this, I've created a friendship with Phil, and I think that is very beneficial. So I want to thank Phil for pushing me into this. And I'm happy to say a word about this. Now, I want to say a word to both of you. I think you can hear better if you're down there, because it's hard to hear. We don't have the monitor up here, and it's kind of reverberating. So if you're having a hard time with the reverberation, you might want to sit down there. And I promise to be short, and you can come back up here. Okay? When we decided that how we would do this tonight, Phil said, well, do we flip a coin to see who goes first? And I said, no. I tell you what let's do. Let's be historical. The Catholics were here before the Protestants, so you start, and I'll come along several centuries later, okay? So I want to begin tonight by talking about that, and I want to begin with the way Protestants theologize and look at life. And to understand the Protestant mentality, you need to know that at the heart and center of the Protestant tradition, there is a belief that under the grace of God, humanity has been given finite freedom in which it is to make choices that shape and mold human life and society. Now, if you are a historian and you want to go back to the time of the 16th century Reformation, you will hear again and again the voices of reformers lifting up the old idea that St. Paul gave when he wrote to the church at Rome. And Paul said, "We are guided by the Spirit of God so that we may grow up into the glorious liberty as sons and daughters of God." And the reformers took that idea seriously, and they began to exercise their religious freedom. Zwingli spoke out in Zurich. Luther stood before the Diet of Worms in Germany. Calvin created a theocracy in Geneva. Thomas Cranmer rewrote the prayer book in England. John Wesley broke from the confines of the Anglican Church to speak to people in factory and field in England. And Thomas Coke and Francis Asbury created the Methodist Episcopal Church in America. These are only a few of the reformers who spoke about liberty, the glorious liberty which stretched the Christian faith into new frontiers of belief. And as different and diverse as these reformers were, and they were all different, they shared one universally held premise, and that was this: that every man and woman is open to the promptings of God's Spirit, and no church, no authority, no power can speak for the individual. In matters of faith, said the reformers, the individual must speak for him or herself, or else the individual will forfeit the life God gave that individual to live. In other words, choice. Individual human choice is at the heart of the Protestant spirit. And you can evidence that by just looking around Wichita and seeing all of the Protestant churches. Generally, those churches do not think alike, they don't speak alike, and they do not worship alike. They do not agree in matters of faith, conscience, moral, and ethics. And because of this, to the rest of the world, us Protestants look like a really surly lot. And we are. And if Protestants don't agree on matters of faith, conscience, morals, and ethics, why then should we assume that they would agree on the volatile idea and issue of abortion? In the Protestant tradition, you will find those adamantly against abortion and those adamantly in support of the right of a woman to make the choice of abortion. And this is why tonight, as I stand here, I will not speak for all Protestants on the issue of abortion. In fact, I will not even speak for my own congregation on the issue of abortion. But I will tell you about my United Methodist denomination's official stand on abortion and my personal views regarding that stand. In doing this, I want all of you to know that my presentation regarding my denomination's abortion position in no way defines all United Methodists. We have a saying in the United Methodist Church, where 10 United Methodists come together, you will find 15 points of view. That means 5 of them change their mind in the course of the discussion. This does not make for unanimity of feeling, but it does make for some really exciting church meetings. Here's what Methodists say about abortion. And the following I take from the social principles of the United Methodist Church as they're contained in the United Methodist Book of Discipline, Part 3, paragraph 70 through 76. For those of you who do not understand that, let me say a word. The United Methodist Book of Discipline defines for our denomination the order and administrative structure of all United Methodist churches and contains the theological foundation for our denomination. To put it very simply, it's our official book. So listen to what we say. Quote, "Our belief in the sanctity of unborn human life makes us reluctant to approve abortion. But we are equally bound to respect the sacredness of the life and well-being of the mother, for whom devastating damage may result from an unacceptable pregnancy. In continuity with past Christian teaching, we recognize the tragic conflicts of life with life that may justify abortion, and in such cases, support the legal option of abortion under proper medical procedures. We cannot affirm abortion as an acceptable means of birth control, and we unconditionally reject it as a means of gender selection. We call all Christians to a searching and prayerful inquiry into the sorts of conditions that may warrant abortion." What is this tragic conflict of life with life that may justify abortion? It is the human situation in which a woman must decide between her emotional and physical health, her economic and social situation, and the future life of the unborn fetus. Whatever choice she makes is difficult. If she carries a fetus to term and places it for adoption, that is a difficult choice. If she carries a fetus to term and chooses to keep the newborn, this too is difficult, especially if she's a single parent. If she aborts the fetus, that decision is difficult. Whatever choice she makes, she is in the position of life contending with life. The late Protestant theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer described this human situation by saying, "She is the one who must observe, judge, weigh up, decide, and act. She is the one who must examine her motives, her prospects, the value and purpose of her action. And this she must do in the realm of relativity, in the shadow which her situation spreads over good and bad, and she must decide in the midst of innumerable perspectives and possibilities." That, my friends, is the human predicament. It is the situation which the Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno called the tragic sense of life. And this condition of finite existence has been given to us by God. It is called the state of separateness, and it is the condition of human finitude. And in this situation, United Methodists believe that a woman, in the liberty of God, must be free to decide for herself the course of her action. And whatever her choice, she stands still in the grace and in the love of God. In 1973, the United States Supreme Court decided in Roe v. Wade that a woman had the right to choose the option of abortion. And this removed the legal barrier that in years past set women into back alleys seeking illegal abortions when they could not complete a pregnancy. Roe versus Wade did not, however, make the choice of abortion easy for women or for their partners. All Roe versus Wade did was to give women the right to choose. And the right to choose in no way presumes that every woman will choose to abort. Life contends with life. And given this, the United Methodist position goes on to say in our social principles that in these moments of great difficulty and tragedy, all of us who are Christian are called not to judgment, but to a searching and prayerful inquiry into the conditions that may warrant abortion. But what of the unborn? Is there no regard in this statement for the unborn? The United Methodist Church says this, quote, that a profound regard for the unborn human life must be weighed alongside an equally profound regard for fully developed personhood, particularly when the physical, mental, and emotional health of the pregnant woman and her family show reason to be seriously threatened by the new life just forming. The argument that the unborn has no choice in the matter of abortion is indeed correct. The unborn has no choice over what sperm and egg creates its embryo. It has no choice in what uterus it will mature and grow. It has no choice about its genetic makeup. It has no choice over the situation into which it is born. The unborn does not have a choice, and in fact will not have a choice until it is birthed and begins to receive the maturation of childhood provided by family and the child's social community. Wait a minute. If the fetus has no choice, then what, Reverend Gardner, do Christians do with the biblical idea that the unborn is formed in the image of God? Psalm 139 says, "You created my inmost self. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Your eyes could see my embryo." Doesn't this give the unborn a right to be birthed? The psalmist in 139, or in Psalm 22, is not speaking literally, but metaphorically. The writer is saying that life is in God, Not that God knows every individual embryo in every mother's womb. We know from reproductive medicine that at the moment of conception, when one sperm unites with one egg, this connection is one out of 10 million possibilities at that moment. Medically, conception in the best of circumstances has a 19% chance of occurring. Put those two facts together, and what one gets is not a divine preordained embryo placed in a woman's womb by God, but an embryo that has been created out of the randomness of the human reproductive process. Does abortion end a potential life? Yes, it does. But the potential fetus is no more the birth child than the acorn is the oak tree or the seed the flower. Decisions like this, we have no right to make those decisions. But I suggest to you that if we are human, we cannot avoid choices like these. In human existence, we are always daily in the position of making life and death choices. The late humanitarian, musician, theologian, philosopher, Dr. Albert Schweitzer, spoke to this idea when he said, "The drama of human existence, indeed, the drama of existence itself, can be described as one will to live divided against another will to live. In creation, one existence holds its own at the cost of another. Every day that you and I feed ourselves, we take a form of life for our nourishment, a life and death situation. Something dies so that you and I can live. And what is true of the human food chain is also true in human reproduction. It is not possible for everything that is conceived to live. Miscarriages tell us that. Social situations that deprive the newborn of human compassion or even physical survival tell us that not everything that is conceived will live. It is, as Schweitzer said, human existence reflects the drama of one will to live pitted against another will to live. So how do we make sense out of this? Well, the old doctor added this thought: there's only one way. You must look at this human drama, see how it works, and then bow before it and create in your heart a reverence for life. How is that possible? Reverence begins when we understand life's tragic nature and respect the principle that all of life exists and it feeds another form of life, and that is life's sacrificial nature. Remember the Native American hunter that kills the deer for his food? But before he takes it, he goes up to it and prays, "My brother, today you gave your life for me. Tomorrow, I may give my life for another." That is reverence. In the case of an unwanted pregnancy, reverence is practiced by respecting the woman and her partner and the choices they must make and supporting them with compassion and acceptance. Instead of condemning, reverence nurtures those who struggle with unwanted and unplanned pregnancies and offers them compassion as they work through their choices. And reverence then stands with them in whatever choices they make That is reverence for life. It is moral. It is ethical. It is at the heart of the Christian faith. Now, I want to state clearly at this point that my statement so far is not a defense for abortion. In fact, in all of the abortion discussions in which I have participated, I have never once found a person who stood on the platform for abortion. Choice, yes. Abortion, no. Those who care about this issue, including my church, only state that abortion is one among other alternatives that should be available to women as they make decisions regarding their reproductive life. Theologically, I believe that all sons and daughters of God created in this glorious liberty must make reproductive decisions for themselves. For a woman not to have the full range of control over her reproductive life is to deny her liberty. If a man has control over his reproductive life, and this is his liberty, then women should have control over their reproductive life because that is their liberty. No state, no church, no idea should take that liberty from them. Now, there may be much in what I've said with which you disagree, and that's all right. Because out of our different views, I think clarity grows. Sometimes in discussing ideas, solutions that are not immediately apparent will be revealed as the discussion unfolds and is shared. But regardless of how far apart we are on the subject of abortion, let me pose some areas in which I think all of us, regardless of our stance, could come together. One, all of us could commit ourselves to back off of our extreme positions of pro-life and pro-choice. I have never met a pro-choice person that was not pro-life. And I have never met a pro-life person that did not practice choice in theirs. These labels do not adequately describe the abortion debate and are way too simplistic over a complicated idea like abortion. I believe if we took the time to have more forums like this and we would do what Reed suggested, not look for winners and losers, but instead look for common ground, we might find the grounds on which we grant liberty to women and care and compassion to newborn children. Secondly, I think all of us could come together around the idea of teaching human sexual responsibility. If we were to deal with sexual responsibility, the idea of abortion would not be as apparent as it is. And this idea needs to be taught in family, in school, church, community, wherever we can reach people with ideas that reflect respect for others and the dignity and beauty in loving another person sexually. Third, I think all of us could come together around the idea of improving our society's adoption procedures. Adoption in our country is a process that is in place, but it works very selectively and it is extremely expensive. We could improve that system so that good people possibly could raise children that otherwise would have no place. And if we desire to really care for our children, then it would seem to me we could come together also around the area of more services, social services especially, for women and children, instead of finding ways to eliminate the funds that provide these programs for the most vulnerable people in our society. And finally, most of all, I think we might be able to come together if we could all understand that we are still in the business of creating human society and we have not perfected it yet. We are still divided against ourselves. And so perhaps all of us need to listen again to the wonderful words from the old prophet Micah, who said, "Let me tell you what the Lord requires of us: justice, mercy, and the compassion to walk humbly with one another and with God. When we do this, we will live together and search out common understandings for these problems that trouble us."